You're listening to another.
Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It is October the 9th, 2015. Fall is well underway, and the lunacy coming at us from every direction is well underway also. So I thank you for joining me. And if you find this program to be interesting, worthwhile, the information that you're not getting elsewhere, please forward this website and the podcasts of my program to as many of your friends, many of your neighbors as you can. This is about providing perspectives on immigration that you're not going to hear anywhere else. Too many people for far too long have made too much money and garnered too much power through the immigration system. It's been portrayed for the longest time as a single issue. I always like to make the point it's really a singular issue, because there isn't a challenge or threat that's not being impacted by this issue of border security, effective immigration law enforcement, bringing in the cheap labor, bringing in the tourists, bringing in the foreign students. But meanwhile, the greedy seem to have forgotten that if they damage America, and indeed they are, then we're all in deep trouble. America needs to lead, and we cannot lead when we are weakened. And the failures at border security and immigration enforcement undermine national security, undermine the U.S. economy. It's wreaking havoc with the middle class. And again, when we hear about compassion, somehow the needs of Americans in their own country and the needs of our children and their children are left out of the discussion, and that has got to change. So that's the purpose for this program. Those of you familiar with my show who have been listening know what this is about. Those of you who are new, I welcome you. But again, my goal is to provide the information that you're not going to see or hear in the mainstream media. Again, if you're familiar with me, you know I am affiliated with a bunch of websites, but let me put it out there at the beginning of my program, my own personal website, Michael Cutler, C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, michaelcutler.net. For many years, I've been affiliated with Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org, C-A-P-S. In fact, I have an article up on CAPS Web recently, September 30th, and I called it "The Refugee Resettlement Program Raises Unsettling Issues." Worth checking out, worth looking at what the other writers have to say at capsweb.org. Also, Front Page Magazine. Front Page Mag, I write for Progressives for Immigration Reform, The Social Contract. As I say, I've been a man on a mission, going back even before the attacks of 9/11, but 9/11 kind of brought everything into focus, and so here we are. Today, what I really want to look at to begin with is this issue of the refugee resettlement program, especially refugees from Syria. And I want to start out by telling you that I certainly relate to the plight of those refugees. My own mother came to the United States ahead of the Holocaust. We're Jewish. My mother's mother, my grandmother, was killed in the Holocaust. I was named for her. We need to be compassionate. Absolutely no argument in my mind about the need for compassion. However, we have no idea who is coming out of Syria, supposedly, because right now there is chaos. When the head of the FBI testified before Congress, when the head of the counterterrorism division, Mike Steinbeck, testified before Congress, he also made the point that Syria is essentially a failed state. There are no databases that we can refer to. You don't simply run the fingerprints and the computer screen lights up and we say, ah, yes, the guy has O negative blood, and his father's name was so-and-so, and he went to this school. We have no idea who we're dealing with. We have absolutely no idea. And, you know, so many people think, well, if you run fingerprints, you're going to know. You're not going to know. not unless the person was fingerprinted in the United States or in a relative handful of countries. Very often, fingerprints come back no record, and we could be dealing with terrorists, spies, war criminals, human rights violators. This is why very often you'll see stories, and we saw it going back to the Second World War. The Nazis who came to America were able to hide themselves in communities around the country. They just dug out another one of these pieces of trash a couple of weeks ago, a woman. I think she's in her 90s now. So understand that there's no magic. Garbage in, garbage out, as computer people will tell you. And if we don't know who these people are and we let them into the country, we are inviting a catastrophe. I want to make a comparison. I've made the comparison before about the attacks of 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, but I want to kind of turn it a little bit on its ear. In the past, when I've talked about Pearl Harbor and I talked about 9/11, I said, well, you know, we had roughly the same number of casualties, and it took the United States, and we weren't even a superpower back then, whatever that term even means today, but it took us all the 44 months working in close cooperation with our allies, and some of them weren't really such good allies to begin with. For example, the old Soviet Union with Stalin. That's a hell of an ally. But we worked with them for the common cause of defeating fascism and Nazism. And we were successful. It took 44 months. Our country was attacked in 1993, not once, but twice, by individuals from the Middle East who came to the United States, gamed the visa process, gamed immigration benefit programs, in some cases claiming to have been agricultural workers, in some cases claiming political asylum. They gamed the systems, and in fact, I did my first congressional hearing May 20th, 1997, about those issues. And this may sound like we're reworking history, but here's something that I want you to think about when you think of those images of the hundreds of thousands of people pouring out of the Middle East. On December 7th, 1941, the day that Pearl Harbor was attacked, the day that President Roosevelt said would live in infamy, it took the Japanese military, their Navy, and many of their aviators to inflict incredible damage at Pearl Harbor, sinking our warships and killing roughly 3,000 people. On September 11th, 2001, 19 young men inflicted the same number of casualties, not in what was a U.S. possession. Hawaii wasn't the state when Pearl Harbor was attacked. But now we're talking about 19 individuals who were able to get into the United States by gaming the immigration system and inflicting more casualties, actually, than we lost on December 7th, when you consider that right now over 70,000 people, first responders and people who lived in these communities, who are now suffering from their exposure to toxins that were released when the airplanes crashed into the Trade Center, crashed into the Pentagon, and crashed into that field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. So the casualty count is way higher. The attack occurred in lower Manhattan, next door to Wall Street, next door to the financial center. It hit us right in the heart. It hit us at the Pentagon. 19 people. 19. Not thousands of sailors and aviators. 19. And it didn't cost a lot of money either. Airplane tickets and a couple of other incidental expenses. We are now looking at America potentially about to be flooded with nearly 200,000 people claiming to be refugees from Syria. I just want you to stop and let what I've said to you sink in. 19 terrorists changed not only America, but changed the world on 9/11. We are now poised to admit over 200 or nearly 200,000 refugees, supposedly. And I say supposedly because at congressional hearings, with the exception of Jay Johnson, the Secretary of Homeland Security, I called the Department of Homeland Surrender, who is the lapdog to this administration, who is the ventriloquist's dummy, if you will, for this president, who will say anything that he needs to say to keep his job. He will go along to get along. It does not get worse than that. Not in an era where lives are on the line and the future of our nation and the free world are on the line. But if you listen to Comey, the head of the FBI, if you listen to Mike Steinbeck, the assistant director for the FBI, who heads up the counterterrorism division, both of those guys at the FBI are in total, complete, lockstep agreement. There is no way to vet the people coming out of the Middle East who claim to be Syrian. Would you let a stranger into your home if you couldn't see their face through the people? I mean, you'd have to be pretty crazy to do that, wouldn't you? So I don't care what Jay Johnson has to say. As I said, he's a ventriloquist dummy. I don't know how he sleeps at night. I have no idea what goes on between his ears or in his heart or in his brain. But when you listen to the people at the FBI, now we're not talking about low level, we're talking about the director and the assistant director who heads up the counterterrorism effort. They've been crystal clear. There have been others who have been crystal clear on this. And I can tell you, having conducted investigations into terrorists and conducted investigations into foreign nationals who were engaged in nefarious crimes in our country, the first challenge that we have is to properly identify these people. And we have no idea. We have absolutely no idea who they are. Why in the world would the United States do this? Senator Jeff Sessions held a hearing on October the 1st, 2015, just about a week and a half ago, and I watched that hearing, and if you read the article that I wrote about it, I urge you to go to Front Page Magazine. And in fact, the article that I wrote, and we're going to talk a little bit about my article, Concealing the Facts on Refugee Resettlement, a case study on how the media and duplicitous politicians hide the truth from the public. Front Page Magazine, please read that article. I've included links to the hearing that Senator Sessions conducted. And in fact, Trey Gowdy, who I had the privilege of meeting a couple of weeks ago when I was down in South Carolina in Spartanburg, I was the keynote speaker at an event where the local folks came out greatly concerned about this issue of refugees being resettled in their community. And then I spoke before the county council, and we'll get into that also. And I have to tell you, if you think Washington doesn't listen to its own citizenry, you would think that a county council in a relatively small town of Spartanburg would be listening to their own constituents. They live among these folks. They're right there. And I was flabbergasted at the contempt. There's no other word. The contempt that the chairman of the county council has for his neighbors. Mind-boggling. So you look at all of this, you look at what Senator Sessions had to say. He hammered away at the witnesses who were provided by the administration. The focus of the hearing was on how we were going to vet these people and what the impact would be on the economy as well, national security and the economy. That's what immigration's about, folks. It's not about dishwashers. I think we're well past that by now. I hope we are. And it was amazing to listen to these stooges. And you could see they were uncomfortable. You know, they were doing the twitch. When I was a kid, Chubby Checkers did the twist. These witnesses were doing the twitch because they knew what they were saying was absurd. You know, they were asked, well, are you screening these people? And this one young man said, well, we're leaving no stone unturned. And Senator Sessions, to his credit, former prosecutor, and it was so relevant. It's interesting, both he and Trey Gowdy are former prosecutors. Their styles are different. Trey Gowdy is a hard charger. Jeff Sessions, you know, as I guess you would expect, the gentleman from Alabama, although South Carolina is certainly part of the South also, but he has that genteel way of saying things. But my goodness, he could cut you to ribbons with that soft voice. I mean, I just love the work that both of those true leaders in our Congress do. You know, people say, get rid of all the Congress, be careful. Be careful. Sessions is a national treasure. Trey Gowdy is doing an amazing job. Thank God they're there. Thank God that they are a gift to our nation and to our people. And Sessions said to this guy, well, I know you're turning over every stone, but what do you have to turn over? What access do you have? Well, whatever we have available, we're looking at it, you know. It was that kind of an answer. And then he spoke to the woman who heads up the refugee program for the Department of Homeland Surrender, DHS. And she said, well, you know, if people have no records, because that was one of the questions, what do you do if they don't have documents? Well, we check, and if they claim that their house was taken down by a barrel bomb, and it's in the newspaper, and this person says they came from that building, so we understand that there's no way for them to have records, so, you know, that's okay then. And I found myself sitting in my house, screaming at my computer almost, because this is absurd. This is absurd. So if everybody figures out, well, the building at 123 Main Street, you know, the equivalent, it's not going to be Main Street in Syria, but I don't know how to translate that into Arabic, but the equivalent. So you see, well, there was a bombing run, and this building was destroyed, and that, all you got to now do is memorize that address, and you come to the embassy, and you say, yeah, I lived at 123 Main Street. The building is gone. I lost everything, including my passport and all of my ID. Really? You know, we had a lot of aliens in the United States with the 86 amnesty, Mr. Reagan's gift to us. It's both political parties. This isn't a left-right issue, folks. This is a right-wrong issue. Reagan gave us the first amnesty. And good old Chuck Schumer, boy, you got to love that guy, don't you? Created the agricultural provisions of the 86 amnesty. I met with him in 85. He didn't even want to have a conversation with me. I had worked closely with Al D'Amato to help create the aggravated felon reentry law to get deportation hearings conducted inside prisons and so forth. And I thought, wow, it was easy to work with Al D'Amato. I was up there almost for an entire year. Every Wednesday night I would go to his Midtown office. His staff would be waiting for me. They usually had either a deli sandwich or at the very least, coffee and Danish, something, as we like to say in Yiddish, a nash, you know, a snack. But more often than not, it was actually dinner. And we would work for hours. And this went on for a year. And we got the law. And we got policy changes. And so when I was told that I was going to have a meeting with Chuck Schumer, I thought, well, you know, I expected the same kind of treatment. I mean, D'Amato was the senior senator, powerful guy in Washington at the time, and he couldn't have been more down to earth, more reasonable. And then I met Chuck Schumer. My goodness, you want to talk about night and day. Arrogant, in your face, and when he didn't want to hear what I had to say, he told me the meeting was over after 5 minutes, and it was supposed to be a 15-minute meeting. When I met with Al D'Amato, we were supposed to have a 30-minute meeting at one of the meetings, and I brought several of my colleagues. And he was so concerned about the issues that we raised that then-Senator Al D'Amato stretched what was supposed to be a 30-minute meeting into a two-and-a-half-hour meeting and canceled lunch that he was supposed to have with a foreign ambassador. That was Al D'Amato. Chuck Schumer, after 5 or 6 minutes, said to me, my next appointment's here, you need to leave. And why was he upset? I said to him, Chuck, I don't understand why you're so concerned about providing agricultural workers with amnesty. You don't even have a farm in your district. And this is an open invitation to fraud. Why would you do this? He didn't want to hear it. And there was no having a conversation with Chuck back then. And if he was impossible then, he's totally insufferable now, as we all know. So we had this agricultural amnesty program, and we were doing investigations over at the old INS. And in fact, I helped out with one of the investigations. I was doing the surveillance videos and some other stuff. One of my other members of the squad was the case agent on that squad. What we used to do is help each other with different investigations. If I had a case, they would help me with mine. When they had a case, I would help them with theirs. So I was doing the videotaping. And there was a small little farm in upstate New York, and the farmer was working in cahoots with some of these characters, these illegals from the Middle East. And so a little farm, I mean really little, suddenly had thousands of farmers supposedly working there. if every farmer would have showed up and stood on the farm at the same time, they would have been as crowded as a subway car. So don't you think that the same thing is going to happen here? People are going to know which house was blown up, which building was destroyed, make the claim, oh, yes, my stuff was in that building, and it's gone. And this brilliant woman is going to pick up the newspaper and say, by God, last Thursday that building was destroyed. I guess these people are telling me the truth. Now, what's so frightening about it is that ISIS is all over this thing. They've made it clear that their goal is to come to the United States and kill Americans. So let's go back again. 19 terrorists killed how many people? And we're about to admit 200,000. I mean, it's staggering. And, you know, what Donald Trump said was right. And I'm not, you know, I'm not supporting his candidacy yet. We have a long way to go. But, you know, some of the stuff he's been saying have been spot on, besides raising the issue of immigration. But it's a lot more than Mexico. You know, let me be very clear, and I've been clear about this all along. This isn't about Latinos, Mexico, Latin America. It's about borders and aliens and protecting America and Americans. But Trump said, you know, this could be an open invitation for you know, thousands of our enemy to come pouring into the United States. You know, this could lead to war inside our borders. And he's right. I mean, didn't anybody read the Trojan Horse? Are we that ignorant, that stupid, that self-destructive, that suicidal? Jeff Sessions had a great idea, and Trey Gowdy echoes it. A number of sensible politicians have been echoing this point. There is absolutely no reason to bring these refugees to the United States. It's costly. It undermines our national security. It undermines public safety. It creates a burden for the communities that will wind up with all these people. If you really want to get the most bang for the buck, you need to find safe areas to relocate these people in the Middle East, not far from their homeland. Take care of them there, provide them with housing and food and shelter, whatever they need over there. And it would cost a tiny fraction of what it would cost to bring them here. Because you would like to believe, at least I would, that the goal for all of us is to get peace in the Middle East. It probably won't happen with the current occupant of the Oval Office, but I hope that whoever replaces him will do just that and do so quickly. And then these folks can go back home. I'm sure that's where they want to be and where they belong, if they are legitimately refugees. But what came out of the hearing, according to Jeff Sessions, is that 3 out of 4 supposed Syrian refugees showing up in Europe aren't from Syria and aren't refugees. They are from Iran, they are from Pakistan, they're from Eastern Europe, they're from everywhere, and many of them are economic refugees, and others are fugitives potentially, and possibly, and I think very likely, terrorists. If you can't screen them, you must not let them into the United States of America. And I don't care what Mr. Parrot, Jay Johnson, had to say, parroting the words of Obama. I want you to think about what Comey, James Comey, the head of the FBI, said, and what Mike Steinbach had to say. I mean, this is a courageous move on their part to stand there and tell the truth at a congressional hearing. We cannot screen these people. It's remarkable. It's astonishing. We have a war on terror. We've watched the beheadings in the Middle East. And we know that they have their sights set on the United States of America. And it's not conjecture. We were attacked in 93 twice. We were attacked on 9/11. There have been other attacks that have not been successful, thank God. And then you had the Boston Marathon, which was, from the terrorist perspective, successful. From normal people's perspective, a disaster. Innocent people killed, hundreds injured. This is an ongoing threat. You almost have to wonder if these politicians aren't looking for the MVP award from ISIS, from al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front, as it's alternatively called, from al-Qaeda. This makes no sense. And then you've got that genius, Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut, saying, you know, this process of screening these people takes too long. We got to streamline it. Just bring them here. Just bring them here. Senator Blumenthal. What in the world is he thinking? We don't know who these people are. And at a time like this, when the goal of terrorists is to enter our country to attack us, what more should I have to even say? Isn't it self-evident that this creates unacceptable risks for America and Americans? And when I went to South Carolina, and I was working with my friend Lauren Martell, who has been a guest on my program a number of times. We've known each other for years. She helped to arrange for me to speak at the Tea Party Convention in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. She invited me to do the event. The New York Times was there, and I didn't even realize it initially. And, you know, if you get a few hundred people together, they got to say some things that are a little bit outlandish. Whether it's tongue-in-cheek or not doesn't much matter. But that was the focus of the New York Times article. What they did not say, by the way, what they did not say in that article, or that reporter did not say, Richard Fawcett, who's the bureau chief, by the way, for the New York Times in Atlanta. This was not a cub reporter. This wasn't Jimmy Olsen. But what he did say was, you know, these people were essentially, in his mind, redneck xenophobes. I mean, that was the image he painted. He left out the fact that I was the keynote speaker. Now, I don't care whether my name is in the New York Times. It's been there before. I didn't think it was a big deal then. It's certainly not a big deal now. But the reason I make that point is you would think that if a journalist attends an event, who, what, where, when, why, and how are the questions that must be answered? How do you attend a public event and not make note of who the keynote speaker was? And the article was lengthy. It wasn't a short article. And when I called him up a week later, he became very apologetic. He said, well, you know, Mr. I was going to put your name there, but it wound up on the cutting room floor. I didn't have enough room. And I said, stop. Don't you think you could have said that the people of South Carolina invited an expert on the subject because they're trying to get to the truth, to get to the facts? Because it would have said something about their efforts. I mean, they paid my way to come down and do that, give that talk, and then appear the next day before the county council. You know, I've been called by both Democrats and Republicans to testify before Congress. That's significant. They're trying to gather the facts so they understand the issue because they're very much concerned, and they should be. And they should be. And he kind of stuttered and stammered, and he said, well, I don't have an agenda. I said, did I say you had an agenda? Well, between you and me, folks, if he had to say to me I didn't have an agenda, guess what? He has an agenda. Richard Fawcett had an agenda. There's no other way of looking at it. And then he started to tell me how immigrants who come to America almost never commit crime, and he started talking about the Pew Hispanic Center and the study they did. And I said, they used the word immigrant. Do they differentiate legal from illegal? He said, no, immigrants are immigrants. I said, no, they're not. House guests are not burglars. House guests are not burglars. And he said, well, they came up with these statistics. And I said, well, let me give you a statistic. In the late 80s, early 90s, and I'm sure the statistic is pretty much the same now, in New York City, 60% of the people arrested by the DEA for drug-related crimes in New York City were foreign-born, 30% nationally. And he said, well, where'd you get that ridiculous statistic from? I said, well, when I was assigned to DEA intelligence back then, I compiled those statistics by reviewing all of the DEA arrest records and other materials that were made available to me. And suddenly he had to get off the phone. Understand something. The other side, the open borders crowd, the immigration anarchists, aren't interested in the truth. They're interested in an agenda. If you say, let's enforce the immigration laws, you're not being anti-immigrant, you're being pro-enforcement. Let's be honest about it. Pro-enforcement doesn't mean anti-immigrant, because the laws that tell us who to kick out also tell us who to let in. We admit more than a million lawful immigrants every year. We naturalize more than a half million new citizens every year under the laws that I supported and administered for my 30-year career. Does that sound like I'm anti-immigrant if I was part of the process whereby we bring in a million immigrants every year? No, it's pro-enforcement. But pro-enforcement sounds reasonable. Talking about a group of folks in South Carolina inviting in a speaker who has been, you know, me, the stuff I've done, let's be blunt. Well, that would have been reasonable. I've testified as an expert witness at trials. So, you know, if he had written the story fairly, he would have said that these folks in Spartanburg, South Carolina, are concerned about the news reports, about the inability to properly screen these people. And these charitable organizations, so-called, that are being given huge amounts of money to run these programs are moving them into their community, and they want to make certain that it doesn't do harm to themselves or their children. So they had a town hall meeting and asked me to participate to provide my perspectives and my concerns and share ideas and answer their questions. Does that sound unreasonable? I don't think it does. But see, this wasn't about being reasonable. This wasn't about being a journalist. This was about saying that all these rednecks, he didn't use the word, but, you know, you read the article, you see what the tone was. It's disgusting. Americans have every right to question what their government is doing. The biggest problem we have, ladies and gentlemen, is that we don't question. I mean, I do. I'm sure you do. I'm glad you're listening to my program. But how many of our neighbors, I mean, think about Waters World on O'Reilly or when Leno was on, you know, jaywalking. How many people don't even know who their congressman is or how long a senator serves in the Senate? Just give them their new iPhone, let them play fantasy football or whatever, and they'll be happy. There's the problem. And so the media goes out of its way very often, outfits like the New York Times, to vilify anybody who says, wait a minute, this isn't a good idea. This isn't a good idea. And the next day when I went before the county council, the arrangement that had been worked out by the residents of Spartanburg, and I'll tell you, their hospitality was wonderful. I felt like I had known these people for years. They could not have been warmer or more welcoming. It was wonderful being with them. I hope to go back soon. They thought they had it worked out with the council that they would give their time to me so I would get to speak for 30 minutes at this meeting, this county council meeting. Because there's a 30-minute question and answer session, and everyone said, you know, we're going to yield our time to my color. So I prepared my remarks accordingly. I walk in, and the chairman of the council runs through a bunch of stuff. They're having street closings and repaving this and fixing that, and they hired a new guy for this, and you know, all the typical town business. And then they get to this issue about the resettlement program. And according to the State Department, if the county says, we don't want these people, they won't force them into a community. So all the council had to do, at least in theory, is to tell State Department, the people of this community have misgivings, we don't want it. That they wouldn't say a word. They wouldn't intervene. They sat there like, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, and certainly speak no evil. So they called the first person to speak. It was a young lady, as I recall, a woman, and she got up and said, I am yielding my time to Mr. Cutler. I started to stand up, and I mean, you had to see the look on this guy's face. Furious, he said, no. If you don't want to speak, that's fine, but you're not giving Mr. Cutler any of your time. Nobody is. He gets 3 minutes, and that's it. And she said, but, you know, I thought this was about getting to the facts. He said, yes, if he can present them in 3 minutes, not any more than that. There was no reason for this. I've been to other situations like this around the country. This was very unusual. It's happened once or twice before. But, I mean, this guy was really, in my judgment, venomous. And why not let the person speak? I mean, what's going to happen if I get to speak for 30 minutes? He might learn something. It was remarkable. So I suddenly had to quickly reconfigure what I was going to say. You know, talk about trying to put 10 pounds of stuff in a 5-pound bag. Suddenly I'm trying to put 50 pounds of stuff in a 5-pound bag. And I got up and I said, you know, Tip O'Neill used to say that all politics is local, the former Speaker of the House. I said, I'm here to tell you that law enforcement and public safety are local. On 9/11, America was attacked. But let's be blunt about this. On 9/11, it was my hometown, New York City, that got hammered the worst. That's where the World Trade Center complex was reduced to rubble and where we suffered the greatest number of casualties. All law enforcement and public safety are local. And I said, you, as members of the council, need to understand your responsibility to the folks of this community. If your decisions cause problems, you will be held accountable. And you had to see them squirming. And I provided them with a couple of quick examples of terrorists getting to be U.S. citizens, Faisal Shahzad, the Tsarnaev brothers, there were a couple of others. And I said, the system is far from perfect, and we've seen the testimony from experts who are trying to screen these people and are making it clear that they cannot, if you listen to what Jeff Sessions has to say. And I explained my background, as I did at the beginning of the program, which I thought was important, because I want everybody to understand that I'm more than empathetic with the plight of refugees. But first and foremost, my concern is for our fellow American citizens and the future of our nation. And that should be the concern of our elected representatives, whether it's on the county, the state, or the federal level. Don't you think? Don't you think? And when I sat down, the rest of the people kind of followed that pattern and said, you know, we're going to hold you accountable, and why are you doing this, and so forth. And these guys were doing the squirm up on the platform, all seven of them. And I presented them all with a copy of the Social Contract Summer Edition, the one that I've spoken about on my program before, that includes my article about 9/11, the threat of terrorism, and where we are today, 14 years after the attacks. We left there and went over to the Palmetto Women's Country, Women's Republican Club over at the nearby hotel. I think it was a Sheraton Hotel. And the guest speaker was Trey Gowdy. We had an interesting exchange of questions, and then I met with him afterwards. The guy is truly a leader. He truly gets it. Gowdy understands the issue. I'm sorry that they've postponed that hearing. I hope that they hold it soon. But when you see what Jeff Sessions had to say, when you see what the witnesses offered in response to his very direct and clear questions, you realize that what is happening with this refugee program is potentially catastrophic. I mean, if 19 terrorists could kill so many people and inflict so much damage, what could 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 terrorists do? Because, you see, if we admit 200,000 refugees and only 1% are affiliated with ISIS, and from what we're hearing from Europe, three-quarters of the people are not Syrian, so God knows who they are, what their goals are. God only knows. But if we wind up where only 1% of 200,000 supposed Syrian refugees turn out to be affiliated with ISIS, al-Nusra, or some other terrorist organization, I don't even want to imagine the damage that 2,000 terrorists can do to us from inside the borders of our country. That's the issue, folks. This isn't xenophobia. Hardly. Hardly. And you sit there in front of this town council, this county council, high and mighty, lofty leaders, my goodness gracious. Remains for me is, will the people in Spartanburg allow them to continue on, or will they vote them out? Because they need to vote them the hell out of office. This is not representation. This is not looking out for the well-being of the people who elected you to represent them and their families. You know, I'm registered as a Democrat. And the traditional argument between the conservatives and the liberals is how much government is the right amount of government. The more conservative you are, the smaller you want government to be. I don't want government getting into stuff it shouldn't be getting into, but I don't have a problem with government doing certain things, and my Republican friends disagree. And by the way, disagreements like that are healthy, because I think it's important to disagree with people when you disagree and have those debates and have the discussions, because nobody has all the answers. Some of the best lessons I've learned by participating in debates and listening to my opponent with an open mind. What a wonderful idea for everybody. Have those debates. We're not enemies when we disagree. We're just Americans with a different viewpoint. But no matter what you think, no matter what you think the role of government should be, I don't know any sane, rational person who's not in the Looney Tune asylum who does not think that public safety and national security are legitimate key issues. They are required by the Constitution, in point of fact, to prevent invasion. So the Democrats that want big government don't care who we're admitting. I would love to see a situation develop where people, and you know, kind of what they call, it's a Bivens-type lawsuit. If a law enforcement officer uses excessive force and somebody dies or gets grievously injured, and it turned out that that officer was acting outside the scope of his or her authority, you can sue them as individuals for acting outside of the scope of their authority. But they had no right to make the stop. If everything escalated quickly and there was no legal justification, you could find yourself in the middle of a lawsuit. Wouldn't it be nice if people were able to do this to the politicians? We now have a growing number of sanctuary cities in America. After the Kate Steinle case, which wasn't isolated, it was brought to the public attention because she was a stunningly beautiful young lady. So, of course, you know, the salacious reporters, the yentas out there, the busybody, oh, she was gorgeous. Well, yes, she was. Yes, she was. And her life was precious and irreplaceable. Yes, it was. But is somebody who's not so attractive or not so young less significant? Really? Because you see, every single day, the Steinle situation is happening in cities and towns all over America. This is not an isolated incident. It is the norm, not the exception. And with all that going on, you have Richard Blumenthal jumping up and down and saying, oh my God, why does it take so long to screen refugees? And you have mayors and so forth creating more opportunities for more illegal aliens to move into their communities. And I'd love to know, what are they thinking? I'd love to know, what are they thinking? The Greatest Generation pulled our chestnuts out of the fire during the Second World War. This generation is like, it could, God forbid, wind up the last generation, because you have people in positions of authority who don't deserve the jobs they have. And this isn't about left or right. Let's be blunt about it. There's a bunch of Republicans I wouldn't give you, you know, a thimble full of sand for. They're just as bad as the Democrats, but there are those few that I think are really noteworthy. David Vitter, Jeff Sessions, Louie Gohmert in the House, Chuck Grassley. In fact, Senator Grassley invited me to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee March of 2013. They're trying to get to the facts. My good friend Lou Barletta, congressman from Pennsylvania, they're trying so hard. I mean, Jeff Sessions, goodness, I wish he would run for president. I wish Jeff Sessions was running for president. That's a leader. He stands with America. He stands with Americans. He stands with our working people. He understands the damage being done to our country by both parties. By both parties. You look at how many of these politicians running for president want to bring in more H-1B visas and more green cards for people who have skills. Do we really have a skill shortage in America, ladies and gentlemen? Do we really? A skill shortage? HP just fired, I think the number was 30,000. 30,000 American workers. Why aren't they getting rehired? A year ago, Silicon Valley canned 20,000 American programmers. Disney fired 500 and told the people they fired, hey, if you want your severance package, you're going to have to train the people from India we're bringing in. Marco Rubio wants a 300% increase in the number of H-1B visas. Ted Cruz last year wanted a 500%. Rand Paul said he wanted no limit whatsoever. Come one, come all, come all. And what was so remarkable was Rick Perry was out there, former governor of Texas, former candidate for the presidency, jumping up and down. We must not allow that Iranian oil to flow into the United States because it's going to drive down the value of our oil. Well, I don't want anything from Iran. Nothing. And I don't know why we have a treaty. It's treasonous in my judgment. They're out there chanting death to America, death to Israel, and we're playing let's make a deal. Has Monty Hall moved to the White House? What kind of nonsense is this? But Rick Perry's concern was that by literally flooding the oil market with Iranian oil, because of supply and demand, the price of petroleum was going to drop, and this was going to do harm to petroleum. Never mind that it might help beleaguered Americans who couldn't pay their gasoline bills or their fuel oil bills this coming winter, and never mind that petroleum is an integral part of everything that we touch, pharmaceuticals, fertilizer. Anything that you buy was probably shipped. If it was shipped, petroleum was used for the trucks, for the airplanes, whatever. So, you know, petroleum is a part of our economy. It's a vital component. And by driving down the price of petroleum, it was helping beleaguered Americans. But Rick didn't want to hear that because Rick's concern is, my buddies in the oil field, they need to make more money. And how dare you flood the market with cheap oil? Rick Perry talked a good game, but I know how to secure that border, which is, again, the lie that they all tell. When they tell you how they know how to secure that border, grab your wallet. They're coming for it. Because, you see, we have 50 border states. I've made this statement many times. I'm not going to rehash it. Just read my article, Border Security and the Immigration Colander, that I wrote a while back for Front Page Magazine. But the point is that it's a charade. It's a false argument. It was Rick Perry who provided in-state tuition for illegal aliens, and Rick Perry who was willing to work with the Dreamers. And by the way, the Dreamers are a threat to national security because the age cutoff is 31. All they have to do is claim they got here by the time they were 15. No interview, no field investigation. Just write the right answers on that sheet, and that adjudications officer, they'll hit it with that approval stamp, and away you go. There's a 97% approval rate for the Dreamers now, 97-plus percent. How close to scrutiny do you think it is? I mean, this is an absurdity. And again, I come back to this point that just 19 terrorists inflicted the same level of damage, I would argue more damage even, than the Japanese Navy did to the United States at Pearl Harbor, 19 terrorists. We have 6,000 foreign students from countries that are affiliated with terrorism who've gone missing in America. That was reported last week, or last year, rather. Incident after incident after incident, the immigration system is a sieve. It is that colander. It is leaking from everywhere. And these great leaders are offering to sort of kind of a little bit plug one of the holes so they can take care of the people that have been writing those campaign checks, which is why I think they're so scared of Donald Trump, because he's not taking those checks. He's not taking those checks. We are in such a perilous era. And that was why when I was asked to go to South Carolina, I felt compelled to do that. I'm heading back to South Carolina, in fact, in a couple of weeks. A bunch of veteran officers in the U.S. military have invited me. A Purple Heart Society of wounded soldiers also invited me. I can't wait to get back there. I'm going to be in Greenville, South Carolina. It's a beautiful part of the country. And if you want to talk about Southern hospitality, other than the county council of Spartanburg, I certainly experienced the best of Southern hospitality, except for the county council. And I'm going to be in Washington doing a seminar for Alan Freed Associates. You see, I've been doing everything I can to get people to wake up. If you know of speaking opportunities, let me know. But we've got to confront these politicians with their lies, this nonsense that we need to import more foreign workers. We can't afford this. You look at the remittances, you look at the loss in wages, you look at the loss of the American tax base, you look at the fact that there is no longer consumerism in America. We've demolished the middle class. We've demolished it. Wages are lower now than they were 20 years ago. Actual wages are down. And, you know, I just worked on an article for Front Page Magazine, this notion about wage equality. Be careful what you wish for. No one's asking how they're going to be made equal and to whom they're going to be made equal. That article should be out this coming week. I mean, it's remarkable, folks. The reason we're in such trouble comes back to immigration. If we stopped hiring foreign workers in the United States, legal and illegal, immediately the national debt would start to shrink every year. Because the remittances alone, the money being wired out of the United States by foreign workers, more than explains the annual growth in America's national debt. And then it's the cost of educating the kids, health care, wage suppression of Americans, Americans who go from being middle class, tax-paying, working consumers to people with no jobs, living on safety net programs through no fault of their own. So instead of contributing money in the form of taxes, they're pulling money out of the economy on food stamps and housing subsidies and all these other programs that are very costly and to hardworking people, very humiliating. The number of people on long-term disability doubled or tripled under this administration. Do you think people woke up lazy one morning after they worked for 25 years and busted their rear ends? Of course not. Of course not. It's villainous to vilify, if you will, hardworking Americans who, through no fault of their own, lose their jobs to foreign workers, and that process has been aided and abetted by the Republicans at least as much as the Democrats, maybe more so. That was why John Boehner always stood there with that cretin from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I call it the U.S. Chamber of Horrors. So understand what we're dealing with. This push for cheap labor is destroying America. America can't afford cheap labor. And that's what we're getting, cheap labor. Rick Perry understood it when it was petroleum. Oh, we can't do that. But cheap labor, I guarantee you he's all in. I guarantee you all these other Republicans who are voting for these H-1B, and you know the words they use, they're just so cool, aren't they? Mr. Rubio says, oh, you know, we have to modernize the immigration system. Modernize? You mean it's old-fashioned? Yes, it's old-fashioned, because the immigration laws were designed to protect American lives and the jobs of American workers. What an old-fashioned, quaint idea. Old-fashioned. We need to modernize. Yes. We need to screw more Americans out of their jobs and out of their share of the American dream. And we have to make certain that their kids have nowhere to go, even when they run up those huge student loan bills. More than $1.2 trillion outstanding student loans. And we've never had more American kids unable to find work, even after they graduate with honors in the STEM professions. But right now, we have 400,000 foreign students studying the STEM curriculum here in the United States. And you have the politicians saying, once they graduate, staple the green card onto their diploma. Let's see how many more Americans we can fire. How many more Americans can we lay off? How much more can we shrink our tax base? How much more can we destroy the middle class of the United States and with it the American dream? How much more? That's the issue. That's the issue. Hillary talks about wage equality. And yet the Clinton Foundation, with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, are out there on the web. Go look them up. You'll see it. Or you'll see it in my article to be published shortly. You know, how are women around the world being treated? Hey, Hillary, how about how are women in the United States being treated? How are men in the United States being treated? If you believe that Bill Gates is a philanthropist, I've said it before, I'll say it again. If you believe he's a philanthropist, then you would believe that the guy that puts cheese on a mousetrap is trying to feed hungry mice. Look up Microsoft Africa, but spell Africa with a K. A-F-R-I-K-A. His philanthropy in Africa is about developing a new market and probably new resources in terms of factories and materials and so forth. There's nothing altruistic about Bill Gates. He's not doing this out of the kindness of his heart, but it's understandable. When you're worth tens of billions of dollars, goodness, how do you even begin to imagine how you're going to take care of putting dinner on the table, right? Like the Americans who get laid off from Microsoft and all these other companies in Silicon Valley. It's anti-American. And our own government is leading the charge. And you've got mayors expanding the notion of sanctuary cities, undermining public safety and national security. And the administration doesn't say a word, but they certainly knew how to sue Arizona, thing SB 1070. The immigration law. This is all self-destructive, folks. And we, the people, are really the ones responsible by not being involved. Not you. I want to believe that if you're listening to my program, you are involved, and I thank you for your involvement. But please, go to michaelcutler.net, go to capsweb.org, Front Page Magazine, The Social Contract, Progressives for Immigration Reform, and occasionally I enjoy throwing an article into the Daily Caller, Tucker Carlson's great website. It's about getting the information out there. And when people start talking about compassion, you tell them compassion should be applying for American families and American kids before it applies to anybody else. When there's a building fire, when there's a terrible bus accident, and you see the parents racing to that scene, who do you expect the parents to pull out of the wreckage first? A stranger's child or their own child? Of course, you take care of your own first, except in America. In America today, if you look at these politicians and if you wonder why the outsiders are currying so much favor, it's because they know that their government is no longer backing them up. Maybe they don't understand it the way that we do, but they sense it. This is about the destruction of the middle class, the destruction of the American dream. We actually need to have a new position in the government, the official auctioneer, so they can auction off bits of America, bits of the American dream, and the future of our children. Please, folks, I ask you to get involved. I want to remind you all that democracy is not a spectator sport. I thank you so much for joining me, for listening to the program. Please pass the information along to as many folks as you can. I'm trying to create my bucket brigade of truth. Have a great weekend, everybody. See you next week, same time, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour.